Welcome to Prevent Connect Audio.
Welcome to a Prevent Connect Audio conference recording. The following was recorded on May 21st at a Call to Men's 2009 Annual National Conference in New York City, New York. To learn more about A Call to Men, visit their website at www.acalltomen.org.
Okay, as I said, each act is a tough one to follow, so here we are. As we put together our program, what we try to do is to provide some diversity in thinking and presentation. So we talked about how to deal with the issue of athletes. What I'm going to do now is invite a panel of men and women to come and talk. We're going to have a discussion about community organizing around this issue, how to engage men and women, bring men and women to the table to talk about this issue. So I'm going to ask the panelists if you can make your way up. You know who you are. And as they come up, Ulester Douglas, who will be moderating, who is from Men Stopping Violence. I'm sure many of you know Ulester. Tony Porter. John Trammell, who's an instructor and trainer for Men Stopping Violence. Tammy Lemmer, program manager from Michigan Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. David Lomax, who is a community organizer with A Call to Men out in Youngstown, Ohio. Jeff Masashita, who's project manager for Men Today, Men Tomorrow out of Idaho, and Valerie Nash, outreach and social action coordinator for Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. As I said, Ulester is going to moderate this session, and what we're hoping for it to be is a conversation amongst our panelists. So welcome and thank you.
Thanks, Gwen. Hi, everyone. You all awake still after food? All right. Some of you are familiar with the TIM project. Some of you are not, so I'm going to do a brief summary of the project to give some context to the conversation that we are about to engage in. 2 years ago, we submitted a proposal to the Office on Violence Against Women to explore as a concept what it would mean for state coalitions to work with community-based organizations to engage men in ending violence against women, particularly male violence against women. And again, it's the idea behind that it was another approach. I mean, the commitment to women's leadership, women's voices, women engagement, it makes sense that we have, almost 50 state coalitions, domestic violence coalitions, to use that opportunity to see what it would be like to work with community-based organizations again to end male violence against women. So the short of it is that 8 states were selected, and they've engaged in different projects, some of which you will hear about shortly. And so yesterday actually was the culmination of that project with a afternoon conference as a way to bring closer to the project. So we are done. But we thought it would be really helpful to bring to today some of that experience to a broader audience. So what we will start out with as a way to even give a little bit more context is to hear first from each one of the panelists 3 to 5 minutes, 5 the most, and I'm definitely going to watch the clock on this. I'd say ideally go after about 3 minutes, to hear what it was the most challenging and rewarding aspect of the TIM project. TIM stands for the Training Institute for Mobilizing Men. And again, the idea here was that the state domestic violence coalitions were at the center, and they would engage with community-based organizations to work to advance against women. Again, it's sort of a different, another strategy, because while different state coalitions in varying degrees have been doing some version of that, it has not been necessarily part of the state coalition's mission per se to do that. And so with that, I'd like to, no particular order, I'd like you all to choose, to start with the question again about 3 minutes, 4 minutes, what was the most challenging and rewarding aspect in doing the work in the TIM project? See what happens when you don't give any order, right? I like it. Go ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity to go first.
All right.
I represent, I work with the Idaho Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. The rewarding piece for me to coming from a primarily rural state was the fact of knowing that there are other men and women engaged in the prevention work. I shared with these folks yesterday when I got back from Atlanta from our initial meeting, I went and purchased a map and I put pinholes in every state coalition. Primarily to remind myself that there are other folks that are out there doing those work. And so through the TIM project, we've had that connection. John Trammell has done a ton of work connecting us through listservs, conference calls. And Dick Bathurk has been instrumental as a mentor, but also somebody to bounce questions off of. And it made it safe for me to ask those questions that myself as a C student, I always ask, very remedial, have my hand up all the time, and the patience that he had. And so the biggest thing we came back from was intersectionality. If we're going to talk about sexism, we can't do that without looking at race. And we also can't do that without addressing homophobia and people with disabilities, and the list goes on and on. And so I think for us in a predominantly white state, reaching out to those folks who have been seen as second-class citizens primarily, a lot of the Native American tribes have been desecrated and put definitely in lower status, so reaching out. And we've had some wonderful conversations and trainings on these tribal communities of really engaging not only their men but also their women and getting back to that sacred circle. And they're really a model of taking leadership from women. And then part of the challenge is in addressing racism and sexism and homophobia and abilities as a whole. And I'll let the other participants share with you with some of their knowledge and voice, so I won't eat up all your time. Thanks.
I guess that the... I'm David Lomax, community organizer for Call to Men. I guess that the most challenging aspect for me was not so much at the TIM conference, but what I learned from the TIM conference that I took back home with me and that I tried to utilize with mobilizing men. One of the things, just like Jeff was saying when he was talking about intersectionality, is we always talked about the way that women of color were treated in the movement. The reason that I'm in the movement is because there was three special women of color in my life who brought me into the movement in the first place. I'm also a Youngstown, Ohio police officer, and I worked in the domestic violence unit. When I got into the unit, these three women kind of just came to me, and they figured that I was for real, and they kind of took me under their wing, and they taught me how to respect victims, how to talk to victims, and how to listen to victims. So when I started mobilizing men, we had an event where I worked with this Tri-County Family Prevention, this organization. And there was two white women that were the head of this organization that actually had started it. And I was recommended to them through Sojourner House, which was the local shelter that I worked with, where the woman sent me there. We started having a problem where we just started having conflict with the other men that I was working with. And the women, they wanted to run things their way. Not to say that their way was a wrong way or anything, but you were asking men to come in and to try and do things to mobilize men. And then you were asking African-American men to come in. But you didn't want women of color to be a part of it. I had suggested two of these three women to this organization because it was a countywide thing, and they represented Trumbull County, Columbiana County, and I represented Mahoning County, but there was no women from Mahoning County. So I recommended these women of color, and they just kind of seemed to just shy away from it without really giving a real reason as to why they did not want them to be there. Finally, I think one of the most ridiculous reasons that I got was that they told me that one was too busy and the other one was too smart. So I felt that I was just spinning my wheels and I was wasting my time there. Being part of the TEM project and being associated with Sojourner House, I started talking to Tony Porter and I started talking to the women from Sojourner House, and we decided that we would try again, and this time we were going to concentrate on Mahoning County and put most of our concentration into the African-American community. Well, how would we do this? We had to have something that was going to draw people to come to us. So we did an event where we had brought Tony in as the speaker. It was sponsored by Sojourner House. I worked with it myself. We were able to get about 60 people to attend this meeting that we held in October. 60 people, male and female. At the end of that presentation, we asked for people who would want to join us and wanted to be part of this movement and wanted to end violence against women. And we got 14 people who signed up and said that they would come to a follow-up 6 weeks later. 6 weeks later, we held that follow-up, and 9 of the 14 people showed up. Since then, we have been having meetings with men on every Tuesday of the month. We have one meeting every Tuesday. This meeting lasts about 2 hours, and we break it up into three phases. These phases consist of, we have the men come and give their personal experiences of what happened to them since the last time that they were there and what has happened to them in the field of domestic violence and of breaking out of the man box. What they've done since the last time we met that they had to break out of the man box where they were able to help someone else break out of the man box. Then we go into tasks. We have to have tasks for these men to do because you can get a whole bunch of men together, but if you don't have something for them to do, they're not going to stay. So we started finding things, first of all, around the shelter that they could do. And the shelter was kind of run down and it needed some work. So we got men and we started painting and started sprucing up around the place. Well, the whole idea of bringing the men into with the shelter in the first place was they needed male mentors. Because when they would have young men come into the shelter, there was nothing for them to do and they had no role models to look up with. They could, the only male that they were able to look up to was the guy that was abusing their mother. So they needed men to be role models, and we started doing that. However, trying to mentor to people that were in that particular situation, the kids that were in that situation, when the mother left and she took the kids with her, if she went back to the abuser, then he would not allow the kids to come back. So that stopped the mentoring right there. So in order to keep a mentoring program going, we said we have to do something else. And we kind of changed direction. And although we still work with Sojourner House and being mentors for them, we're also reaching out into the community. We have one of our members is Joe McGeorge, and he runs an organization called Warriors Incorporated. And Joe has about 30, maybe 40 kids there, and they need mentors. They need role models. So that's where the group comes in, and we now mentor with them. We have a chess club that we started. Well, actually, Joe McGeorge started that we take the kids to on Wednesday, every Wednesday, and they're going to have a tournament coming up in June. The third phase of the meetings that we have the women coming
David,
in.
David, I'm going to pardon the interruption, bro. I think it's really very helpful, given a description of the project, I mean, because it helps with answering the question. And I'm wondering, because you're nearing the end of your time, if you can take it into then what was most challenging about the experience and what was most rewarding.
I guess then that the most challenging part of the experience for me was the beginning and trying to work with the first group that I worked with. And the most rewarding was that once we got it up and running again, like I was saying, we started out with 9 people, and today we have 28 people, 30 people on the list right now.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Hi, everyone. I'm Valerie from Wisconsin, and I'm the one that's known to talk the most, so I'm sure you, Lester, will be giving me the sign. My challenge in this work is my challenge as well as my benefit. And the challenge isn't the negative part as much as it is literally just the challenge, and that created the opportunity for me to have the benefit. So I want to talk about those simultaneously. And that challenge was that in being involved with this training portion, I was in the presence of other people that were looking to move to the next step. The Wisconsin Coalition is approximately 99 member programs, and we were just beginning to have the conversation around if it was even possible to even consider, if there were a thought, if someone had brought up the topic, that maybe if we said the word in the right sentence, we could possibly talk about incorporating men in some level if we really had a closed circuit of a conversation of a small group, maybe at our table. So that's where we're at. Now, having said that, the dilemma with that is that one of the things that I do is I staff the Communities of People of Color Committee. So on this committee of people who identify of a specific ethnicity on a daily basis, this was already something that they already knew they wanted to happen. But as we provide technical assistance to programs, the programs weren't sure if that's what they wanted to provide to the people that they provided the services to. So that was part of the dilemma. And what has happened is it created some collision for me as an African-American woman in my personal and my professional. So I have this personal life of being a Black woman living in a city that's extremely diverse, that needs services. Having grown up with such a religious background for so long, I kind of understood and was taught back in the day what my role was as a woman in a relationship, in a community. You do not supersede men. And then there's this role as a Black woman. I want my Black brothers to stand up. I want them to be recognized as leaders. I want them to have that voice. And I want to step back so if we could recognize them as men and we can no longer devalue them, that they would do this work. And at the same time, in conflict with what was happening in our community statistic-wise. So here's the personal African-American woman coming in a professional field that doesn't even want to consider what the brothers of all ethnicities can bring to the table. And how do I combine those conversations? How do I have that? How do I have that voice in my community and mobilize around men and mobilize with men, work with men, and also provide with my level of technical assistance, some level of leadership without superseding who I am as a woman, and then translate that to a coalition where is predominantly 99.9% white females. And so that was very, very difficult for me, but this committee created an opportunity for that discussion to take place, which was a true, very, very powerful benefit for me.
Hi, my name is Tammy. I'm with the Michigan Coalition, and similar to Valerie's challenges, being a statewide organization in a very diverse state, we're a dual coalition, which means we have constituents in both the domestic violence work as well as sexual violence work, and we have individuals who are all over the place in terms of their readiness, willingness to recognize what the role of men in preventing violence is, and in some cases, if there's a role. Now, I wholeheartedly believe there is a crucial role, which is why I'm here, and having this project to build relationships with colleagues across the country who are doing this work and having similar challenges has been very rewarding for me personally, and I think professionally I've been able to bring ideas back and have dialogues, conversations with both coalition staff and the community partners. The partnership building is really a success for us in Michigan, I feel, because, for example, we have two community members who have been part of the project and have stayed with the project since our original gathering in Atlanta. And then when we came back from that institute, we actually have we added a few additional male allies to what we're calling our Mobilizing Men in Michigan, 3M work group, And one of those gentlemen is here, David Garvin. He'll be presenting tomorrow. So we've really appreciated his support. And then another individual I'll name who's not here is Rich Tolman, who's a researcher out of University of Michigan. So we have great commitment, great, wonderful perspectives from academics, from the field, from just community organization perspective. A strength for us as well was we in Michigan have been part of a project called the Delta Project for, we're now into our sixth year, which has been a focus on primary prevention, meaning we're looking at preventing the violence before it occurs rather than relying solely on response after the fact. And we've embraced the concept that primary prevention equals social change, and that social change means attitude change, that we need to be changing the attitudes and beliefs of both men and women in order to realize the behavior change, which is a decrease and eventually an end to violence. Conversely, though, that in itself is a challenge because we as a movement have what limited resources we have available, and I by no means want to say that we have what we need, but the very limited resources are directed towards crisis response. And that's, you know, you'd argue where they need to be because life, it's a, you know, life and death situation. But rather than having to carve up the pie differently and shift more resources to prevention, quote unquote, versus response or intervention, we're really trying to create a whole nother pie so that we're not tapping in. Similar to the, we don't want men's programs to be, quote unquote, taking money that could otherwise be going to, quote unquote, women's programs. It's the same with prevention versus intervention. So the issue of understanding that it's not in competition, crisis response and prevention are not competing against each other or shouldn't be, and that the work that we have been traditionally doing with men has been very much focused on the crisis response, either in working with perpetrators, which is statistically male, or in the criminal justice system, which again is overwhelmingly male. So that has been a challenge for us, is to get both men and women to recognize that when we're talking about working with men as allies, that it's in that social change work, it's in that changing of attitudes, and it's not to minimize men who have been working in partnership with us for many, many years, decades in some cases, on the crisis side. We're really reaching out and hoping for the opportunity that there's more conversations like the ones that are happening here about those attitudinal changes, about the masculinity and how do we define that, and the messages that we're giving to our youth, both male and female. So it's been very inspiring and exciting to have colleagues struggling with the same kinds of issues and really forward thinking in terms of in what new ways are we working with men as allies, in particular in Michigan, with a focus on primary prevention.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Trammell, and I'm an instructor trainer with Men Stopping Violence. And one of the things that about my experience as part of the Training Institute for Mobilizing Men project is I had the opportunity to coordinate the project, to work with the TA team as well as the state coalitions and the community partners to organize our communication, to bring us together, to just kind of try to facilitate us moving together as a group and doing this work in our individual states. And as we hear the other participants talk today about the challenges that we all faced, dealing with the intersectionality of oppressions, where in our communities we're dealing with sexism, we're also dealing with racism, with homophobia, with classism, and on and on. But the reality is, we're dealing with that in our interactions with each other as well. And as we deal with that in our interactions with each other, now what do we do with that? Okay, we have these forms of communication that we're limited to, two face-to-face meetings, about eight phone conversations as a group, and then individual communication with a TA provider and a state. And so when these things surface, on top of the fact that the TEM project isn't anyone's sole responsibility. I mean, most everybody is doing about 40 different things. So our focuses are spread, are fragmented to all these different things we're doing. This is one part of that. Then we're dealing with these complex issues of different forms of oppression that are happening in our day-to-day work in our communities, as well as our interactions with each other. And how do we work through those things? That was a really big challenge. Because can you imagine talking about, you know, how we've experienced racism and sexism as a group within our group on a conference call? You know, it's a complex, it's difficult, you know, how do we get real in that situation? But the hope, I mean, the bright spot is that not only did yesterday, I mean, some amazing conversations happen between us as a group. I felt like there was a lot of real talk in the room yesterday. We challenged each other, we supported each other. And also we saw some real successes that came out of the project. I mean, David mentioned, you know, as he struggled through his work in Ohio, but then what came of that? All these men that are together, you know. And so we saw that, we heard that from others as well. And so that is what is hopeful for me and what is, exciting, what I feel like was a real success. And so I'll stop there.
Appreciate you all. I'm Tony. The thing that was most rewarding for me for A Call to Men was the opportunity to collaborate. You know, we're a national organization and we were able to collaborate with another men's organization. You know, Men Can Stop Violence. We've always worked together, you know, in a whole host of ways, but this was a real collaborative effort working with eight different state domestic violence coalitions. And at Rita, going back to some of, you know, what she was sharing this morning about the importance of men's organization to get this whole, as we grow in this movement, one aspect of our man box that is truly showing up called competition is like really, really showing up. And we really got to get away from this. And part of the whole idea of bringing many of the men who are known as national leaders, and there are so many more that are not here, but those that we, you know, were able to bring, we brought here together just to really try to work through some of that, for us to all be together, hang out together, break some bread together, you know, work together, laugh together, you know, the whole deal. And being with working in this way with Men Can Stop Violence was a wonderful opportunity for A Call to Men. So that was really the high point for us. I appreciated the struggle. We struggled a lot. One thing we did that really put us in the struggle mode with good intentions, you know, well-meaning, with good intentions, was we had put a requirement in the interview selection process that one person on each team had to be a person of color. Well, for the obvious reasons, I'm sure you can know, understand, and appreciate that. But the piece we didn't think through. The grant is with coalitions, that relationship, that's who we have to work with, coalitions. And then there's the community partner that they're going to work with. And then we're going to provide technical assistance, so, and then how we're going to then mobilize men in communities. So when we say the coalitions, one of the partners have to be a person of, one of the persons, not partners, persons, have from your team has to be a person of color. What we didn't think through is that the large majority of coalitions are largely all white women, particularly those in leadership. And in such a project, 9 out of 10 times, they're going to send someone in leadership. So the stage that wound up being set was that we had white women representing the coalition. The partner from the community, by the way, had to be a man to mobilize men. That was the plan. So then 9 out of 10 times he's going to be a black, a Latin man. So what did we put in place was white women, black or Latin man, you know, and those were most of the teams look like. We were blessed that we had a few women of color, such as Valerie and a couple of others, that were also there, and such a burden wound up being placed on their shoulders. You know, to carry and push the room in the right direction. So, you know, even in our righteousness, you know, there were some lessons learned around how we put it together. And even with those challenges, I think those challenges really created some wonderful opportunities, because the entire project really shifted on us around the issues of the intersections of oppression. Whether we was talking about race oppression, class oppression, whether we was talking about heterosexism, those three in particular. Well, I would say particularly race and homophobia, heterosexism, were in the room alive, and we struggled. You know, we worked and we struggled. And so I think that was a personal blessing for us all. But in regards to the work in the community, while you'll hear some stories about different things we did that was pretty cool, some really good work, that triangle, that I kind of call it a triangle, kind of way I see black men, white women, well, men of color, white women, women of color, white women in leadership, women of color dealing with their own struggle with that leadership. Black men being brought into the movement because a lot of the grants are targeted toward communities of color around prevention. So he gets hired by a white woman, but he has an allegiance and a loyalty to women of color, or he should. But he wants his job, too. And he steps in, and he's trying to figure out his place, and his stuff already going on. White women tell him, this is your job, this is what you do. Women of color tell him, this is what's going on, this is what you need to do. Right? And you got the white guys sitting over here practicing privileges, you know, privilege. They could choose to get involved or just watch. Mm. Right? Well, our TIM project took some of that on, not purposefully, but what I loved about it, we dealt with it. We struggled and we dealt with it, thanks to some sisters like Valerie who had to take the weight and put it on their shoulders, but we got it right in the middle of the room. You know, I've done a lot of addictions work, and we talk a lot about the pink elephant when we talk about dysfunction, you know, in regards to families suffering from addictions. That pink elephant, it didn't just stay in the middle of the room, everybody looking at it and acting like we don't see it. We got right there and dealt with it. So that also turned out to be a blessing in the project. I think it brought us closer together, probably made some friends for life out of the struggles and the intimacy that we share.
All right. Can we at least acknowledge the sharing? Yeah. You know, what is remarkable is my brothers and sisters stayed within the allotted time. I'm telling you, panels could be really something else, you know, especially when they're big, but I'm looking at the clock here, right on. So it was mentioned, but I want to illuminate it further, to really acknowledge that in this organizing effort, because again, at Men Stopping Violence, as with A Call to Men, we are clear that this is about organizing all men to stand with women to end male violence against women. It's not about Battles Intervention Program as a focus. We're really attempting to really, again, emphasize prevention. And so it was wonderful, one of the many strengths in this project, to partner. It was a collaboration partnership with A Call to Men. And I want to acknowledge also the National Network to End Domestic Violence, NNEDV, and I know we have some reps here from NNEDV who really supported us in helping in putting this together, recognizing the states. You know, Karma in particular was really quite helpful in making this happen. So thank you, NNEDV, for your help. And also thanks to the support of the Office on Violence Against Women to provide the funds to make this possible. Thank you all the reps from OBW. Yeah, I don't know how many OBW folks here. At least I know three. I think it is Darlene, Latanisha, and Rudell. Anybody else? That's it? Okay, thank you.
Gil Lester.
All right.
Gil Lester, can I speak to the resources piece? Would that be appropriate?
Which resource piece? What do you mean by the resource piece?
Well, you mentioned OVW, Office on Violence Against Women, did provide funding for this project. And really, that funding was in bringing the partnership together between Men Stopping Violence and A Call to Men. As coalitions, we individually came up with our own resources to do the two national trips, the staffing and the time for the ongoing conference calls and things like that. And I say that not to say, you know, oh, woe is us, the coalitions, but just as an example that you can actually put time and energy into something even when you don't have a grant for it, that there are opportunities to do this work.
Thank you, Tammy. That was really helpful because, again, one of the requirements in when we send out the proposal was demonstrated commitment to working with men to end violence against women. And part of that means having the resources to attend two national conferences and so on and so on. So, yeah, that's a really important point. All right, I want, before we go on, to take this moment to invite the audience into the conversation before we get to the next set of questions, to hear if anybody has any questions for any one of the panelists. This is a moment. I don't know what the acoustics are like, so if it can be heard, so standing up might be helpful, and then again, it may not, and you may not be able to stand. So what works for you, we'd like to hear your voice. Anybody has, we'll just take a couple. Any questions for any one of the panelists about the project? I can't see upstairs, so. Anybody has a hand up? No? All right. How about that? All right. Tony, you mentioned one of the challenges, and it is true, yesterday in particular, we really got in the room and really addressed directly, head on, if you may, some of the issues that were mentioned here. One of the things that we acknowledged was, generally speaking, it was our sense, in terms of lessons learned, that coalitions in general were not particularly interested in working with men to end violence against women. And that has a lot of meaning. Of course, again, that's not true of every state coalition, but I think we together concluded that in general, there was not a real investment in coalitions, domestic violence coalitions, in working with men. So I would like to invite a couple of you, not everybody, to speak. What do you see, what does that mean to you as who you are, as someone working to end male violence against women, that state coalitions, generally speaking, have not demonstrated that commitment in working to, in wanting to work with men to end male violence against women? And what do you see as some solutions to that? There are times I will call on someone, but I purposely don't call on folks to see what happens. Anybody?
Well, I think, here's Valerie again. I think for me, one of the difficulties is that as you look at communities, and when you hear the voice of, in particular, what I've heard from women of color and other underrepresented populations is that the key thing is they want the violence to end. They want their family to stay intact, however that family is designed, however that family makeup is, whether it's extended family or immediate family. So that does include male counterparts, whether that's the spouse, whether that's the uncle, whether that's someone that was like a daddy to me. However that plays itself out. So when we talk about preserving communities and enriching families and building and moving moving generations past where we are now, the way that we view women, we have to incorporate those pieces. So when you have an older generation that has whose shoulders that now we stand on and future generations will stand on, and yet that uncomfortableness of change can't take place, that difficult conversations about what do men mean, and do, when we say men, do we really mean minority men, and who all do we mean, and how do we define all of that? When we can't bring all those pieces together and what makes a community and a family, it makes it very difficult for me working at a coalition to know that this is what this community wants, but our programs say, no, we think this is better for you as a community. And it's very, very difficult, especially coming from some of those communities and then having sisters within those other communities. It's extremely hard. I am hoping that as we move into a new season of change, that people are willing to have the conversations and to hear, not to keep telling me what they found in their research that works best for them, but that they hear what people are saying about what people need to do, what they need to do in order to strengthen their families and their communities. And that's where I see the big gap in communication at on the state level, because it's typically people who have never been to that community, don't know anyone in that community. And this could be rural or urban. It could be LGBT. It could be some form of ethnicity or another culture. But you have no conversation with that. And yet we're making programs to deal with that. So,
We're also polite. We're just going to let each other talk the whole time. I think to add that, I mean, one part of our conversation yesterday was like, you know, what leverage does the coalition have that they can provide to local communities who know their communities best to do this work, you know, instead of the coalition needing to manage it and be the owner of the project, how can they provide that support to the local communities based on the access to resources they have, the connections to funding, that they can provide whatever support, like Valerie said, that the community needs, that the community knows best how to take care of their community, and the state coalition can provide those resources and that access to make that happen. And I think that's I'm sure Texas wouldn't mind me using them as an example. Hilda, who is the representative from Texas, yesterday shared about the toolkit that they're developing, in which they're disseminating to all their local communities. It's like, here's resources, here's some ideas. This isn't the way to do it. This isn't the only. We're not giving you a mandate of here's how you do it, but here's some things that can help you, support you. We're not going to come to your community and say, here, we're going to do it for you. We're just going to give you these resources, this toolkit, and we're going to get your feedback on the toolkit before we're finished with it so that it can be something that really helps you do this work well in your communities, because we have connections to these other organizations, national organizations, funding organizations that maybe local community groups don't have access to or don't have the confidence to approach because they feel like, oh, they'll just throw my proposal in the garbage if I send it in because, you know, we're the small town here or there or whatever. And so I think that's one of the conversations that I think was really helpful yesterday is us saying this is an important way that coalitions can be part of the role they can play in organizing and mobilizing men in communities. So.
And just to bring a different side to it, at the state coalition, our executive director in 2004 sought money to start the Men Today, Men Tomorrow. It's a primary prevention program engaging men. So we were a little different coming into the TIM project. We'd had a few years of on-the-ground work and trying to get the plan rolling. So the coalition in Idaho was focused on prevention and engaging men. What I found was being the token male, token minority, being thrust out at a coalition gathering just saying, here it is, we've got a man, and it happens to be a man of color, so we're progressive. But being what we found, though, was the resistance in communities. Our memberships throughout most of the rural state were still hesitant to have me come in and do programming. We had men come to the table, but the leadership piece, as Tony illustrated earlier, the man box. Nobody wanted to step out of that box and take on that leadership role of pushing themselves out and saying, you know what, I'll be the organizer. You know, we developed an action plan with different roles, and it was detailed. It was great. Obviously, I had no hand in it, being I couldn't keep a thought. But where we came down to was this great plan, and nobody would want to step forward to do it. So what we backed up now, what we found is the rural communities have seen our activities, the events we do, such as Walk a Mile in Her Shoes or 4th of July Parade, and they've actually wanted to engage in those things. So my training partner and I, Brian Leiden, now, we get to travel around the state and get paid for it and set up these events. And so they're one-time quick hitters, but the growth, I think, comes from the fact of once the seeds have been planted and engaging men, particularly law enforcement and school men in schools, those men buying in, those leadership positions they have, it allows other men to kind of break the ice and at least come forward and, if nothing else, clap their hands to see men stumble and bumble in high-heel shoes or put themselves out in a 4th of July parade. So if nothing else, the encouragement of a model behavior from the state capitol going out the rest of the state, that's the model behavior has been a plus for us.
I want to build on this before the next person go, if there was anyone who was interested in going. I think this is a critical issue because the assumption is if particularly we're talking about male violence against women, be it sexual, physical, or otherwise, in the context of intimate partnerships, then it makes sense that men are involved in this work because we are the ones who are committing the violence. If we're talking about, you know, 90%+ of the cases in heterosexual intimate partner violence. So, again, to repeat, it makes sense that men be in the mix, standing with, you know, women, again, in that very narrow construct of gender. So why do you think there is such resistance by generally speaking, state DV coalitions to engage with men? And I'd like to hear a rep from one of the coalitions, not that you represent all coalitions, you know, we're clear about that, and at least from one of the men, not that you represent all men's voices. What reasons do you think there's such resistance, given that it seems to make sense that that kind of collaboration and engagement happen?
Well, I'm proud to say that in Michigan, we do have the leadership. Our executive director, actually pretty much everybody, has been very supportive, even to the extent that we have just completed a strategic plan, a primary prevention plan for ending domestic and sexual violence, and that a core component of that plan, it's in writing that we recognize the importance of working with men. I think that the challenges, whether they be challenges from our other coalition colleagues, but also resistance or hesitation that we are seeing in our member agencies, what's been shared to me has been we've been burned in the past when we've reached out. We've been taken advantage of, literally and figuratively, by the male partners that we've been working with in a variety of different ways. That's the sort of the overt resistance. I think there's also a complacency and or a misunderstanding, as I was saying earlier, about what are we talking about when we're talking about working with men or the role of men, because we in fact did a survey in Michigan. That was a big part of what we've launched. Again, because we're so diverse, we didn't feel we were in a position to do a statewide project. We really did recognize the voices of the community, or we attempted to, by finding out who's already doing what kinds of support and resources do you need, et cetera. And in that survey, you know, we were finding people all over the place in terms of what they were already doing, what they were defining as working with men. And in some cases, you know, we'd ask the question, in what way do you currently work with men? And the response would be, well, we have a man on our board, or, you know, we've worked with this one individual for a really long time. And again, that's not to minimize that individual's role, but it, in my opinion, minimizes the opportunities. And it really minimizes the opportunity to promote positive, healthy relationships, to be the role models, to establish men in communities, the nonviolent, well-meaning men that we're hearing about here, having the opportunity for them to step up and to help educate our youth, rather than looking at the male partners that we've traditionally had, again, criminal justice or probation or batterers intervention, where they've played a role. And historically, you know, there's still a lot of debate about whether or not that has been effective, if our working with men, quote unquote, has been effective in the past. So I think there's a historical distrust and a historical frustration, and perhaps not enough people thinking in a more open, out-of-the-box way to say, well, we're talking about doing something differently here. We're not trying to do the same thing. We're not trying to bring men in to do the same things that they have, in fact, been doing. We want new men, men who aren't tied to this profession, this movement. We need the everyday man. We need the men who recognize that violence is wrong, but they don't think they're connected to it. It's that us, them. Well, I would never do that, so I'm the good guy. But asking them to be the good guy in another way by actually standing up and speaking out.
As I'm talking, I'm going to give you a second. If you don't have a pen or a pencil, if you could take that out, because I do want you to write this down. And that's to have the website for the Women of Color Network. They have done some extensive work around the topic of ally research, interviewing. They've done extensive work. And the reason I bring that up, and I'd like for you to write that down, is because I think there's a false belief that there are groups of people who have cornered the market on who they are as allies, that they have this belief that we're the ones that stand next to you, and we understand the battered woman, we understand the voice of the battered woman, and we're your ally, and we're the only ones who can do this, and we need to be careful and cautious of anyone else that we haven't determined who the ally is. And if you get a chance, the Women of Color Network has statements on their website that talks about what it means if you're aspiring to be an ally and what it means as defined by women of color, what an ally is. And I think what has happened is that it's been a wake-up call for a lot of people who thought they were the voice of what needed to be said, of what women in this field of domestic violence needed, what families needed, and they've excluded lots of other people, whether they be male or whether they be heterosexual, whether they be gay or lesbian, whether they be old or young. They've just excluded people, communities, and they've taken the role of being an ally. And I think that that's one of the questions that needs to be put out, is that who decides who is the support for what the voice of the battered woman needs and what the domestic violence movement needs, what the sexual assault movement needs, and who can do that and who can do that best, and whose movement is it and who's in charge of it and who do I get to listen to? And I think all those questions have been answered by a small group of people, and we have not even opened up the opportunity for anyone else that wants a voice. And I know that there are some other dynamics of, well, they might take our funding, the men might do this, and then we're going to lose it. I know that there are other real discussions that need to take place, but in the context of real discussions, we have to be honest of who owns it. And whose is it? And whose name did we give to it? And originally, who all started this to begin with? And once you started, does it still belong to you? And how do you share it? And how do you expand it so that whoever was talking about the program about Generation 5 and in five generations, you know, not dealing with some of these things, that means there comes a time when we have to move and expand, and those voices and those talents and those people that want to expand with us at the level and the place that they're at. I mean, I get excluded for a lot of things for whatever, I think, because I speak out too much, you know, but you don't always get invited to the table when someone deems you not appropriate. And we have to be careful with that. We have to be very, very careful. And as our funding sources like OVW and some of the other ones are moving into looking at programs, they're going to be looking at how we bring those voices together. So I would encourage you, and I might be telling a lie on this one, but I think it's WOCN.org. Ms. Tanya? What's... womenofcolornetwork.org. Don't forget that HTTP, orange, green, yellow, all that stuff that comes before it. But I would encourage you and to utilize those resources, because that was honest discussion with a lot of people that came out with some real discussion around who gets to say, who gets to be involved, and how that happens, and how you see your role, because you can't assign yourself the role of whose voice it is. You have to allow the people who have the voice to say what they need. So.
Thank you, Valerie, for that. Thank you all, Tammy. I also want to lift up Tanya Lovelace. She's the project manager there at the Women of Color Network. And she'll be speaking tomorrow along with Desiree Allen Cruz, who's also one of the leading members at the Women of Color Network. So you're in for a good time, a lot of lessons and listening and learning tomorrow. I'm going back to your first question, sorry, but it's just in regards to organizing. Organizing is a bottom-up process where it will be most effective. Folks here who are being impacted, you know, in the community, on a community level, organizing. And organizing through coalitions is a top-down process, state coalitions. That's the way I see it anyway. I think, but for us in this movement where we're used to funding in many respects going through coalitions, so that's kind of like a natural process for a domestic violence funding, that they go through coalitions. And one of the things that came out of our conversation yesterday was the need for funding to really happen where there's resources available for this kind of organizing, for it to happen or to be provided on a community level. All right, that's where the funding needs to come. It needs to be on the community level. It would be wonderful if local domestic violence, sexual assault programs are working in collaboration with, they are wonderful, wonderful community program storefront joints Y'all know what I'm talking about? Storefront joints that can really, really take these efforts and move them forward. All right? And I think it's more on us. This is the whole competition thing again. This is the whole thing about, you know, Grant, I'm applying. Don't know what I'm going to do, but I know how to cut and paste and get it. You know what I mean? And I'm not talking about coalitions. I'm talking about all of us. You know, I know how to cut and paste because I didn't apply for 2,000 grants. It take me 10 minutes to put together a grant application, right? Because I just cut and paste. If we can get away from that and really identify the organizations that are there in all of our communities that are really best suited, that they can move some of this work forward. It's not that they're not eligible for the grants. Most of them won't apply. They don't think they're going to get it, and they're not encouraged by us and so forth and whatnot. But if we really operated from that standpoint, I think we'd be more effective, and I think it would be a better fit for working with men, men working with state coalitions. In some respects, you know, when I'm hearing what Jeff's talking about, he works for a state coalition, but his job is to go out and work in community. That makes sense. But, you know, men organizing in state coalitions, I just think we'd be much more effective working with local programs, organizing in communities. That's the place. But we, in many of these organizations, domestic violence, sexual assault organizations that's been doing this work forever, that are on first name basis with all the funders, we have to create space. And as long as we're not going to create space, this whole concept of organizing men in communities is kind of far-fetched. It's going to be very difficult to do.
Thank you, Tony. I want to encourage, yes. I want to encourage conversation between the panelists. So if there's questions you have for each other or want to comment, just a reminder that that's part of the experience. So we are attending to the question of the apparent unwillingness or challenge for many state coalitions to want to engage with men. So another opportunity for anyone from the audience who would like to be part of the conversation. Yes, please.
Well, from what I understand from what Texas is doing, I mean, they're going out into the local communities and getting experiences and stories from people who are doing this work in local communities to include that in the toolkit so that that can be shared across the whole state. So that, like, if I'm doing something in El Paso and someone else is in another part of Texas, Dallas, I guess, that someone is doing some great work there in El Paso that could be replicated or at least learned from in Dallas to do something similar that fits better in the Dallas community, then they can see that, hear the story, the anecdotal evidence, and figure out how to put it into place there in their local communities as it best fits. That's kind of what I know they're doing. I mean, so it's a combination of people at the coalition. I know that the Texas has gotten feedback from, like, Men Stop Violence, a call to men on the toolkit as well. So it's coming from a lot of different places in how they put the toolkit together, not just from the staff at the coalition.
Let me check something a minute before we go on to the next question, and maybe briefly. I want to invite whether Hilda wants to elaborate on that and clarify that further. That would make sense since she's the one who... Right back there. Ted, would you give the mic to the sister back there to repeat the question, please? Hilda wants the question repeated. Thank you.
I had asked, with the toolkits that are going into the communities, I asked who put the tools in the kit, and then who's going to show the community how to use the tools, And are all the tools craftsmen, or are there some Black and Decker in there?
Okay. Thank you for that question. So the tools are coming from a variety of sources. As we stated, we're using the spectrum of prevention to really talk about what prevention looks like at different levels of the community. And our hopes are that people that are working with domestic violence agencies will be using these resources in their communities and building leadership within their communities. So that's really where it's coming from. And we are collecting anecdotal information from different parts of the state of people that are doing this work, so they could, you know, have some quote-unquote experts in the field that are organic, that are local, and that they can help support their efforts. So the information that's coming that we have as part of the toolkit, some of it is the Man Box, for example, which is an awesome thing that Paul Kibble contributed to the movement, and other such things, right? So just a whole bunch of information and resources that we're able to obtain on the state, local, and also in the national levels. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Hilda. Appreciate it.
I can talk to you afterwards if you have more questions.
Great idea. This is a good moment to acknowledge again all the eight states, because they're not all represented here. Again, we have Idaho, Michigan, North Carolina, Carolina, Ohio, Texas, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. All right, let's get to our second question. The next hand I saw was right here. Right, thank you.
Hi, I'm an executive director of a state coalition with the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. And so I just kind of wanted just to go back regarding, just make a comment regarding why coalitions seem resistant to engaging men. And I just personally think that we are personally not fundamentally opposed to that, but I think it's more of a figuring out what is the role and what is the role men will have. And I think that Tony is right on about where we can really utilize men work and really on a local level. And so I really see us as a state coalition as a place to help leverage resources and support the efforts in communities around prevention. So I think that is more of our role. On the other end of that, being one of the only few women of color in leadership and the executive director of a state coalition, I also feel that we still have to have those conversations about women of color and how are we going to engage women of color. We haven't finished having that conversation, and now we're being asked to have another conversation about men. And so I think that we have to find a way to do both without pitting men and women against each other, but also realizing that some of the prevention work that we're talking about is going to take time to really change in communities. So we still need to make sure that the crisis services are still available, because as this work goes on, women are still being abused and beaten and killed. And so how do we do that in a collective way, in a comprehensive way, and leverage resources and not compete with each other?
Thank you. All right. We're going to take, I see two more questions on this segment, and then we're going to shift. So whoever decides, we're going to take two more questions in this section. You got the mic? Okay, go ahead. Sorry, you got the mic already?
Mm-hmm. I was just kind of curious, because the question seems a little strange to me, because the question is like, why are they so resistant to working with men? And the reason it's curious to me is because why aren't they so resistant to working with white and male patriarchal institutions on a regular basis, and resistance to working with men on an individual basis, and primarily with, like, that's my confusion, because it's this strange thing. I feel like, where's the money coming from all of our work? Mm. And then who are the people we're accountable to in terms of our organizations, not our hearts, not our movement, but our organizations? And they're white men. And the very people we spend a lot of resources and energy to convert so that they will maybe minimally, marginally change their basic response as white male institutions, like as police or as healthcare providers, etc., they're all men. And I'm like, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. Resistant to working with men.
Thank you. I think one other person has the mic right here.
Hi, my name is Frank Morris. I'm a preacher. And one of the things I'm hearing this dialogue, and it's great to know that I think most of the groups, most of the organizations acknowledge that men are perpetrating the problem, and there it, but by that very virtue, is a mandate to deal with the man, because that's the problem. So, you know, and what I want to say is that being someone else might be here saying, hey, I want to get involved with a call to men. Tony knows we had to go from, we had to go two towns over to get involved because our local women's group, I'm not going to point them out, but they just, they were paranoid. They did not want to work with us. And so I just say that as and I've heard kind of like some answers from the sister over there from California, but for the well-meaning men, it's hard. And, you know, the bed has been made hard for us, but you really got to try. You may have to go a couple of towns over to get the instruction, but it's worth it. But I just say that as a word of encouragement, because that wall is there. It's real. And so, you know, thanks to Tony and others, we've been helped, and we're able to help others. But you do, the arms are not necessarily going to be open for you. That's what I'm just saying, brother. But please press, because it's a worthwhile cause.
Thank you, sir. All right. I know there are some other hands, and hopefully, again, the next segment will allow for the next set of hands. I'm going to hold on the hands right now for a moment, because we have about 15 minutes left for this presentation, so I'm watching the clock. Another challenge that was acknowledged today, and we had a spirited conversation again yesterday and during the last 2 years, the concept of intersectionality. And I know personally it continues to be one of the most vexing and challenging concepts for me. And I get excited when I go to workshop where there's something being done about it, because I'm really interested in learning about it, because it makes sense to me, and for most people who hear it, it makes sense. You know, the idea that we have, you know, different oppressions, and some may argue that it's not helpful to try to create a hierarchy, that none is greater than the other. Others say, oh yeah, there's some that are, you know, the conversation goes. And so when working to engage men to end male violence against women, as we have experienced, those issues come up. And we've had it in the conference, we've had it in our calls. And so I'm wondering from my brothers and sisters, what do you see, what are your thoughts about intersectionality and the opportunities to really put it into practice? I mean, put it into practice. In terms of its practicality, one person mentioned yesterday, it was a question, that in certain communities, organizing in certain communities, men are like, oh, I don't know about this particular oppression here. All right, I'm down with working to end sexism, but this homosexual thing, I ain't there. And so I don't want to be involved. That's one example, you know, issue of heterosexism. And so the question is it a deal breaker when going into engaging with communities when there are men and women and others who are uninterested or unwilling to really put this into practice? So I'm wondering about a couple thoughts on it. Not everybody, at least maybe two people or so. Your thoughts about that? Somebody said, come on, Valerie.
I always have something to say. But go ahead. Well, I think what I struggled again with, I mentioned early on, is just not only being a black female working in this field and trying to mobilize men, I realized that as much as I thought that I spoke man, that I really didn't speak it that well. And that created some barriers for the gender. And then I began to, which I still do at this point, in all honesty, I still question myself if I'm even in a position to figure out a program or learn to do leadership around what it means to mobilize men. I don't know what my role is in doing that and how can I support that. And being one of two African Americans at the state level, I think there is some, you know, yeah, one of two African Americans at the state level and representing 72 counties, and knowing that I'm listening to a voice that's working through the coalition to do that, I don't know how my gender can help do that. I honestly don't know at this point. And talking with my brothers here, and learning and listening to the man box and all of those things. I don't know how to do that yet. I'm still learning where my role can be in that. And as it relates to even among the communities of color, the hierarchy of oppression that we try to make, you know, whose statistics are greater and who needs the greater funds, and that intersectionality that's operating there. And then again, there for me, it's a geographical location. I live in one city and work in another city that's a and I'm on the road 3 hours a day. Myself and Anika, who works at the Sexual Assault Coalition, we commute an hour and a half one way. And so just the geographical location to be able to work, the mindsets. I mean, I work in an ultra liberal town that insists that they understand ally work, and they have no clue. You know, but I live in a city that is struggling and wants to understand allied work and is not a part of the coalition. I mean, I was glad to see Terry, who's one of the executive directors of the Alma Center in Milwaukee, and the work that they're doing with men, and they're not a part of the coalition, and they're doing some amazing work there, and that loyalty. So for me, that intersection of where I live, urban versus rural, and gender, and all of those things are really, it's a really difficult place to be, and the support not being there for people in the field, in the coalition level, to work those things out on the community level. I don't know. That's all I can say.
Thank you.
For me, it really starts right here. Is that when I'm doing this work, that I have to know myself. I have to have a critical self-examination of who I am as a white male, as a heterosexual male, as a middle-class male. You know, what are the ways in which I have certain belief systems that I need to still take care of and examine and be held accountable to before I go out there and start bringing other men on board? Because if I'm looked at as a man who's speaking to other men, then what I say carries weight with those men. And if I'm colluding with heterosexism, or colluding or being silent in the face of racism in those circles, or if I'm just not thinking about those things, then all the men that I bring together may be white, heterosexual, middle-class men, and we're all doing, and then nobody else is at the table. So you have to know yourself and know where you have privilege and where you have maybe biases or stereotypes or whatever that you're holding on to that are unexamined, and really go to work on those things. And you never arrive. Like, today I still have to do the work. When I woke up this morning, when I'm sitting here now, in my head, I have to do the work because, I, you know, at any moment, those things could surface in my own unexamined stuff. So I think that's very important. And then I think once we have that, and once we encounter various forms of oppression in the work, maybe a guy comes along and he's like, hey, you know, I'm interested in any violence against women, but don't talk to me about homophobia, all right? It's wrong, you know, it's bad at whatever people say, you know? And so how do I challenge that man? But how do I not challenge him in a way that shames him, that isolates him, that says, you're awful, I got it figured out, you're terrible. But I challenge him, and I hold him to it, but I do it in a way that allows a conversation, a dialogue to happen, that maybe he can see something different. And so I think that's what's important to me.
Yeah. Tommy, do you mind holding 1 second?
Sure.
That sounded like kosher. I want to do a follow-up with you, John, and then I want to invite one more question from the audience, and I want to give it to, yes, right, you, because you had your hand up for quite a while, all right? John, I hear many, many, many men with your privileges, white, male, heterosexual, middle-class men, you got it, you know? And you're in the room with women. Let's say women of color, you know, and you have women of color who are lesbian and maybe working class, and so you have the other end of the spectrum, let's say, in terms of benefits and opportunity. By the way, Paul, that was really cool. I like benefits a lot more, too. Benefits, privileges. How do you be in that room? Because a lot of times men say, I can't say anything. I feel like if I say something, I'm going to hit the wrong spot, and there goes the neighborhood, you know? So how do you negotiate that experience with all that benefits that you bring without having to, you don't even have to show up, you know?
Well, thanks, Lester, for inviting that question. that's, you know, I love you, man. So Well, I think, you know, it's difficult, but I think that for me, it's about being, you know, first of all, being very conscious of, you know, how much space am I taking up in that room? You know, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? And why am I feeling certain things? And then when I say certain things, I think it's speaking from my experience and not defining anybody else's reality, not speaking for someone else in the room. And you know, and being willing to be wrong, being willing to be challenged and held accountable, because I may say or slip up or do something, or I may interrupt a woman of color or lesbian, you know, and I may do those things that are going to happen from time to time, and I need to be willing to be held accountable to that for that, but also need to be given the opportunity to stay at the table. And so I think that's how I'm in those spaces.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Before we get to Tammy, I've got you. Let me take the question from the gentleman back there, and then we'll come back to Tammy and we wrap up. Okay.
Thank you very much for letting me ask this question. Actually, it's more of a comment about the two things that were discussed related to competition and resources. I think those are two really important questions that we here, the men here, need to answer in terms of where we're looking for money and where we're looking for resources. The competition part of it is not only competition with the women's movement that has existed for 40 years and has found its way to finding its own money, but the competition within the men's movement around all of the different organizations that are competing, we hope in really brotherly ways and ways that are beneficial for all of us. But I worry that we're losing the sight of the fact that men in this country have the power and the men in this country have the money. And if men in this room and all of our other brothers who are not here are not able to go out there and find, I wrote about this one time a few years ago, 100 men with $100,000 each to build a coalition along the same lines that there's a coalition of women in this country, then we still have really a lot of work to do. And I don't quite frankly care if those men have interest or not. They have money, and we know that money speaks. We know that, up until 1994, I've worked in this field in domestic violence and sexual violence since 1984 as a volunteer, and now as a worker for a Battered Women's Services and hotline organization up in Vermont, small little state. But women got the money themselves. They went around, and whatever money they could raise, they raised to do the work. That's what we need to do. We need to do the work. We can't be looking to women's organizations for ways to raise money from foundations and to get grants. We have the money. That's where the money and the resources needs to come from. We have the brains, we have the understanding. Most of the men in this country don't speak the same language that we speak in this room. So we have a whole vocabulary, a whole language that puts us ahead of the, we get it, but we just need the money to organize. And it has to be coming from the men. We need to stand up and we need to give it up and we need to find those men to give it up as well.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Tammy, you got a minute or less.
Okay. On the resources piece, I think there's an opportunity for us to educate funders, whoever and where they are, quite honestly, whether we're talking federal government down to local community-based foundations, because there is, you know, this mindset of, well, I need to see something for my money. And you don't see prevention right away. You don't see social change. You don't see attitudinal change right away. So that's some educating we can do of men and women in terms of access to resources. And I think similarly, my point I was going to make earlier is speaking again to the role of state coalitions. And I very much have a similar mind in terms of the real hard work is happening in local communities, and that the state coalitions, ideally, if they're doing the work that they're supposed to be doing, should be there in support of what's happening in the local communities via the way we're providing training, making... most coalitions aren't funders. We actually don't get money that we pass through as a rule. But we get funding notices, and we have partners who have money, and it's our role, I believe, to help make those connections so that the local communities are feeling supported and being supported in doing the work that's happening. And so that's what I wanted to share.
Thank you, thank you. Well, I'm thinking, again, for me, with the issue of intersectionality, there are many ways, I think, to stay conscious with it. Just asking oneself the question when we say women and men, starting with what Paul talked about this morning again, recognizing the limitations of that frame, just right there, the limitations of that. And even if we want to make it simple, as problematic as it is, and staying with men and women, just which men, which women are we talking about? Just one small note. It is that time. Thank you all. Please acknowledge our panelists. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me up here. At the end of the last session, I was having what I've now got a great new term for is a Rachel Maddow talk me down moment. And it happened in our last session that the gentleman who stood up and introduced himself as a preacher talked about his challenges and struggles in trying to get his program accepted and implemented in his community. And some of the language that he used put me over the top. And the language that he used was that the organizations that weren't open to accepting his work were paranoid, and that his recommendation was that we keep pushing. And that language so triggered. Thank you. You need to hear why it was. Okay.
Hey, bro, hang on. And take a moment and hear it first, okay? Thanks.
And so it was disturbing, number one, to hear it. It was disturbing in that it triggered for me, it was the language of rape. It was the language of the oppressor. And it was disturbing in the context of what was being spoken about up here, where Tony was talking about the idea of, you know, having programs that are unaffiliated with state coalitions. And if you want to know why some of us are worried about that, it's because of this. And please know that I make no judgments. I know nothing about your work and the quality of the programming that you do. But the language was disturbing. And to the extent that your language perhaps reflects the way of being in the world, it's a problem. I do trust that you're here because you're a very well-intentioned, caring man. But there's a place at which I think the interaction between men and women is absolutely essential for men to be held accountable to doing the work that needs to be done in a way that's fitting to moving to a new place. So that was my level of distress on this. I guess one last level of distress was that in this room full of the most brilliant, well-intended, pro-feminist men that I know of, and I hope many of you know how much I respect the work that you do, that none of you caught it and called him out. So it's distressing. And I'm glad we're all here, and I appreciate that there's the kind of space where I could bring this up. So.
And Irene, I appreciate that you brought it to us, and I'm sorry that I didn't attend to it when I heard it. And I'm hearing you're hearing what Irene said, my brother, and one of the things that might be helpful would be to own the meaning of what you heard for you. Perhaps, you know, I'm uncomfortable with what I just heard, but, you know, take some ownership rather than labeling and suggesting aggressive responses as a way to deal with what you heard. Thanks again.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you, Gwen and Nicole Timen, for giving us this opportunity to do that. Thank you.
Thank you for joining Prevent Connect Audio. Prevent Connect Audio is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect Audio are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. You can contact us at info@preventconnect.org, or you can learn much more on our website at www.preventconnect.org.